Welcome, everyone, to the 13th edition of Sir Malachi's Menagerie of History. This is Sir Malachi, and we are live at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time on Friday, May the 7th, 2010. And it's a nice cold night, windy and rainy, and about 35 degrees here. And tonight's episode is parts 3 and 4 of The Life of Abraham Lincoln, taken from the book of the same name, written by Henry Kitchum. Now, part 3.
Chapter 9, On the Circuit. The requirements of the lawyer in that part of the country at that date were different from the requirements in any part of the world at the present date. The Honorable Joseph H. Schuett, in a lecture at Edinburgh, November 13, 1900, said, "My professional brethren will ask me, how could this rough-back woodsman become the learned and accomplished lawyer? Well, he never did. He never would have earned his salt as a writer for the Signet, nor have won a place as advocate in the court of session, where the teachings of the profession has reached its highest perfection, and centuries of learning and precedent are involved in the equipment of a lawyer. The only means we have of knowing what Lincoln could do is knowing what he did. If his biography teaches anything, it teaches that he never failed to meet the exigencies of any occasion. The study of his life will reveal this fact with increasing emphasis. Many a professional brother looked on Lincoln as this rough-back woodsman, unable to become a learned and accomplished lawyer, to his utter discomfiture. We are justified in saying that if he had undertaken the duties of the Scots writer to the Signet, he would have done them well, as he did every other duty. When Douglas was congratulated in advance upon the ease with which he would vanquish his opponent, he replied that he would rather meet any man in the country in that joint debate than Abraham Lincoln. At another time he said, "Lincoln is one of those peculiar men who perform with admirable skill whatever they undertake." Lincoln's professional duties were in the 8th Judicial Circuit, which then comprised 15 counties. Some of these counties have since been subdivided, so that the territory of that district was larger than would be indicated by the same number of counties today. It was 150 miles long and nearly as wide. There were a few railroads, and the best country roads were extremely poor, so that traveling was burdensome. The court and the lawyers traveled from one county seat to another, sometimes on horseback, sometimes in buggies or wagons, and sometimes afoot. The duties of one county being concluded, the entire company would move on to another county. Thus, only a small part of his duties were transacted at Springfield. These periodic sessions of the court were of general interest to the communities in which they were held. There were no theaters, no lyceums for music or lectures, and few other assemblages of any sort excepting the churches and agriculture fairs. It thus came about that the court was the center of a greater interest than would now be possible. It was the rostrum of the lecturer and the arena of the debate. Nor were comedies lacking in its multifarious proceedings. The attorney was therefore sure of a general audience as well as of court and jury. This peripatetic practice threw the lawyers much into one another's company. There were long evenings to be spent in the country taverns when sociability was above par. Lincoln's inexhaustible fund of wit and humor and his matchless array of stories made him the life of the company. In this number there were many lawyers of real ability. The judge was David Davis, whose culture and legal ability will hardly be questioned by anyone. Judge Davis was almost ludicrously fond of Lincoln. He kept him in his room evenings and was very impatient if Lincoln's talk was interrupted. There were two qualities in Lincoln's antidotes, their resistless fun and their appropriateness. When Lincoln came into court, it was usually with a new story, and as he would tell it in low tones, the lawyers would crowd about him to the neglect of everything else and to the great annoyance of the judge. He once called out, "Mr. Lincoln, we can't hold two courts, one up here and one down there. Either yours or mine must adjourn." Once Lincoln came into the room late, leaned over the clerk's desk, and whispered to him a little story. Thereupon the clerk threw back his head and laughed aloud. The judge thundered out, "Mr. Clerk, you may fine yourself $5 for contempt of court." The clerk quietly replied, "I don't care, the story's worth it." After adjournment, the judge asked him, "What was that story of Lincoln's?" When it was repeated, the judge threw back his head and laughed. He added, "You may remit the fine." A stranger, hearing the fame of Lincoln's stories, attended court, and afterwards said, "The stories are good, but I can't see that they help the case any." An admiring neighbor replied with more zeal and justice than elegance, "Don't you apply that unction to your soul." The neighbor was right. Lincoln had not in vain spent the days and nights of his boyhood and youth with Aesop. His stories were as luminous to the point under consideration as were the stories which explained that this fable teaches. Judge Davis wrote of him that he was able to claim the attention of court and jury when the cause was most uninteresting by the appropriateness of his anecdotes. Those who have tried to claim Judge Davis's attention when he did not want to give it will realize the greatness of praise implied in this concession. To this may be joined the remark of Leonard Swett that any man who took Lincoln for a simple-minded man would wake up with his back in the ditch. As Lincoln would never adopt the methods of his partner Herndon, the latter could not quite grasp the essential greatness of the former, and he uses some patronizing words. We may again quote Judge Davis. In all the elements that constitute a great lawyer, he had few equals. He seized the strong points of a cause and presented them with clearness and great compactness. Generalities and platitudes had no charm for him. An unfailing vein of humor never deserted him. Then follows the passage already quoted. Lincoln could never bring himself to charge late fees. Lehman was his limited partner with the office in Danville and Bloomington for many years. He tells one instance which will illustrate this trait. There was a case of importance for which the fee was fixed in advance at $250, a very moderate fee under the circumstances. It so happened that the case was not contested and the business required only a short time. The client cheerfully paid the fee as agreed. As he went away, Lincoln asked his partner how much he had charged. He replied, $250. "Lehman," he said, "that is all wrong. Give him back at least half of it." Lehman protested that it was according to the agreement and the client was satisfied. "That may be, but I am not satisfied. This is positively wrong. Go call him back and return him half the money at least, or I will not receive one cent of it for my share." One may imagine the amazement of the client to receive back one half of the fee. But the matter did not end here. The affair had attracted the attention of those near at hand, including the court. Judge Davis was of enormous physical size, and his voice was like a foghorn. The author writes this from vivid remembrance. Once in early youth, he quaked in his shoes at the blast of that voice. The conclusion of the incident is given in the words of Lehman. The judge never could whisper, but in this case he probably did his best. At all events, in attempting to whisper to Mr. Lincoln, he trumpeted his rebuke in about these words and in a rasping tone that could be heard all over the courtroom. "Lincoln, I have been watching you and Lehman. You are impoverishing this bar by your picayune charges of fees, and the lawyers have reason to complain about you. You are now almost as poor as Lazarus, and if you don't make people pay more for your services, you will die as poor as Job's turkey." The event justified the judge's remarks. It was not unusual for Lincoln's name as attorney to be found on one side or other of every case on the docket. In other words, his practice was as large as that of any lawyer on the circuit, and he had his full proportion of important cases. But he never accumulated a large sum of money. Probably no other successful lawyer in that region had a smaller income. This is a convincing commentary on his charges. The largest fee he ever received was from the Illinois Central Railroad. The case was tried at Bloomington before the Supreme Court and was won for the road. Lincoln went to Chicago and presented a bill for $2,000 at the offices of the company. "Why," said the official, in real or feigned astonishment, "this is as much as a first-class lawyer would have charged." Lincoln was greatly depressed by this rebuff and would have let the matter drop then and there had not his neighbors heard of it. They persuaded him to raise the fee to $5,000, and six leading lawyers of the state testified that that sum was a moderate charge. Lincoln sued the road for the larger amount and won his case. It is a matter of interest that at that time the vice president of the railroad was George B. McClellan. It was Lincoln's habit always to go to the heart of a case. Quibbles did not interest him. The non-professional public who have attended jury trials will not easily forget the monotonous "I object" of the attorneys, usually followed by "I accept to the rulings of the court," and the clerk will note the exception. Lincoln generally met the objections by the placid remark, "I reckon that's so." Thus he gave up point after point, apparently giving away his case over and over again until his associates were brought to the verge of nervous prostration. After giving away 6 points, he would fasten upon the seventh, which was the pivotal point of the case, and would handle that so as to win. This ought to have been satisfactory, but neither Herndon nor his other associates ever got used to it. Lincoln put his conscience into his legal practice to a greater degree than is common with lawyers. He held, with Blackstone, that law is for the purpose of securing justice, and he would never make use of any technicality for the purpose of thwarting justice. When others maneuvered, he met them by a straightforward dealing. He never did or could take an unfair advantage. On the wrong side of a case, he was worse than useless to his client, and he knew it. He would never take such a case if it could be avoided. His partner Herndon tells how he gave some free and unprofessional advice to one who offered him such a case. "Yes, there is no reasonable doubt but that I can gain your case for you. I can set a whole neighborhood at loggerheads, I can distress a widow mother and her 6 fatherless children, and thereby get for you $600, which rightfully belongs, it appears to me, as much to them as it does to you. I shall not take your case, but will give you a little advice for nothing. You seem a sprightly, energetic man. I would advise you to try your hand at making $600 in some other way." Sometimes, after having entered on a case, he discovered that his client had imposed on him. In his indignation, he even left the courtroom. Once, when the judge sent for him, he refused to return. "Tell the judge my hands are dirty. I came over to wash them." The most important lawsuit in which Lincoln was ever engaged was the McCormick case. McCormick instituted a suit against one Manny for alleged infringements of patents. McCormick virtually claimed the monopoly of the manufacture of harvesting machines. The suit involved a large sum of money besides incidental considerations. The leading attorney for the plaintiff was the Honorable Reverdy Johnson, one of the foremost, if not the foremost, at the bar in the entire country. It was the opportunity of crossing swords with Johnson that, more than anything else, stirred Lincoln's interest. With him for the defense was associated Edward M. Stanton. The case was to be tried at Cincinnati, and all parties were on hand. Lincoln gave an extraordinary amount of care in the preparation of the case, but some little things occurred. Through an open doorway, he heard Stanton make some scornful remarks of him, ridiculing his awkward appearance and his dress particularly, for Lincoln wore linen dusters soiled and disfigured by perspiration. When the time came for apportioning the speeches, Lincoln, although he was thoroughly prepared and by the customs of the bar it was his right to make the argument, courteously offered the opportunity to Stanton, who promptly accepted. It was a great disappointment to Lincoln to miss thus the opportunity of arguing with Reverdy Johnson. Neither did Stanton know what he had missed, nor did Johnson know what a narrow escape he had had. This chapter will not be complete without making mention of Lincoln's professional kindness to the poor and unfortunate. Those who could find no other friends were sure to find a friend in Lincoln. He would freely give his services to the needy. At that time, the Negro found it hard to get help, friendship, and justice. Though Illinois was a free state, public opinion was such that anyone who undertook the cause of the Negro was sure to alienate friends. Lincoln was one of the few who never hesitated at the sacrifice. A young man, a free Negro living in the neighborhood, had been employed as cabin boy on a Mississippi River steamboat. Arriving at New Orleans, he went ashore without a suspicion of what the law was in a slave state. He was arrested for being on the street after dark without a pass, thrown into jail, and fined. Having no money to pay the fine, he was liable to be sold into slavery when his mother, in her distress, came to Lincoln for help. Lincoln sent to the governor to see if there was no way by which this free Negro could be brought home. The governor was sorry that there was not. In a towering wrath, Lincoln exclaimed, "I'll have that Negro back soon, or I'll have a 20 years' excitement in Illinois until the governor does have a legal and constitutional right to do something in the premises." He had both. He and his partner sent to New Orleans the necessary money by which the boy was released and restored to his mother. The 20 years' excitement came later. Chapter 10. Social Life and Marriage. Springfield was largely settled by people born and educated in older and more cultured communities. From the first, it developed a social life of its own. In the years on both sides of 1840, it maintained as large an amount of such social activity as was possible in a new frontier city. In this life, Lincoln was an important factor. The public interest in the man made this necessary, even apart from considerations of his own personal preferences. We have seen that he was extremely sociable in his tastes. He was fond of being among men. Wherever men gathered, there Lincoln went, and wherever Lincoln was, men gathered about him. In the intervals of work, at noon or in the evening, he was always the center of an interested group, and his unparalleled flow of humor, wit, and good nature was the life of the assemblage. This had always been so from childhood. It had become a second nature with him to entertain the crowd, while the crowd came to look upon him as their predestined entertainer. But Lincoln had been brought up in the open air, on the very frontier, far from the maddening crowd. His social expertise and his tastes were with men, not ladies. He was not used to the luxuries of civilization, elegant carpets, fine china, fashionable dress. Though he had great dignity and nobility of soul, he did not have that polish of manners which counts for so much with ladies. His ungainly physique accented this lack. He never could be what is known as a ladies' man. While his friendly nature responded to all sociability, he was not fond of ladies' society. He was naturally in great demand, and he attended all the social gatherings. But when there, he drifted away from the company of the ladies into that of the men, nor were men loath to gather about him. The ladies liked him, but one of them doubtless spoke the truth when she declared that their grievance against him was that he monopolized the attention of the men. This was natural to him. It had been confirmed by years of habit, and by the time he was 30 years old, it was practically impossible for him to adopt the ways acceptable to the ladies. Into this society in Springfield came a pretty, bright, educated, cultured young lady, Miss Mary Todd. She was of an aristocratic family from Kentucky. It is said that she could trace the family genealogy back many centuries. She may have been haughty, she was said to be so, and she may have been exacting in those little matters which make up so large a measure of what is known as polish of manners. These would be precisely the demands which Lincoln was unable to meet. It was a foregone conclusion that the two would be thrown much into each other's society, and that the neighbors would connect them in thought. For Lincoln was the most popular man, and Miss Todd was the most popular young lady in Springfield. It was simply another case of the attraction of opposites, for in everything except their popularity, they were as unlike as they could be. It is proverbial that the course of true love never did run smooth. If there were ripples and eddies and countercurrents in the course of this love, it was in no wise exceptional. It is only the prominence of the parties that has brought this into the strong light of publicity. Much has been written that is both unwarranted and unkind. Even the most confidential friends do not realize the limitations of their knowledge on a matter so intimate. When they say they know all about it, they are grievously mistaken. No love story, outside of novels, is ever told truly. In the first place, the parties themselves do not tell all. They may say they do, but there are some things which neither man nor woman ever tells. In the heart of love there is a holy of holiness into which the most intimate friend is not allowed to look. And in the second place, even the lovers do not see things alike. If both really understood, there could be no misunderstanding. It is then presumptive for even the confidants, and much more for the general public, to claim to know too much of a lover's quarrel. We would gladly pass over this event were it not that certain salient facts are a matter of public record. It is certain that Lincoln became engaged to Miss Todd in the year 1840. It is certain that he broke the engagement on January 1, 1841. It is certain that about that time he had a horrible attack of melancholy. And we have seen that he never outgrew his attachment to his early love, Ann Rutledge. Whether this melancholy was the cause of his breaking the engagement, or was caused by it, we cannot say. Whether the memory of Ann Rutledge had any influence in the matter, we do not know. Whatever the mental cause of this melancholy, there is no doubt that it had also a physical cause. This was his most violent attack, but by no means his only one. It recurred with greater or less severity all through his life. He had been born and had grown up in a climate noted for its malaria. Excepting for the facts that he spent much time in the open air, had abundant exercise, and ate plain food, the laws of sanitation were not thought of. It would be strange if his system were not full of malaria, or, what is only slightly less abominable, of the medicines used to counteract it. In either case, he would be subject to depression. An unfortunate occurrence in a love affair, coming at the time of an attack of melancholy, would doubtless bear abundant and bitter fruit. Certain it is that the engagement was broken, not a little to the chagrin of both ponies. But a kind neighbor, Mrs. Francis, whose husband was editor of the Springfield Journal, interposed with her friendly offices. She invited the two lovers to her house, and they went, each without the knowledge that the other was to be there. Their social converse was thus renewed, and in the company of a third person, Miss Jane, they continued to meet at frequent intervals. Among the admirers of Miss Todd were two young men who came to be widely known. They were Douglas and Shields. With the latter only we are concerned now. He was a red-headed little Irishman, with a peppery temper, the whole being set off with an inordinate vanity. He must have had genuine ability in some direction, or else he was wonderfully lucky, for he was an office holder of some kind or other in different states of the Union nearly all his life. It is doubtful if another person can be named who held as many different offices as he. Certainly no other man has ever represented so many different states in the Senate. At this particular time, Shields was auditor of the state of Illinois. The finances of the state were in a shocking condition. The state banks were not a success, and the currency was nearly worthless. At the same time, it was the only money current, and it was the money of the state. These being the circumstances, the governor, auditor, and treasurer issued a circular forbidding the payment of state taxes in this paper currency of the state. This was clearly an outrage upon the taxpayers. Against this, Lincoln protested, not by a serious argument, but by the merciless satire with which he knew so well how to use upon occasion. Under the pseudonym of Aunt Rebecca, he wrote a letter to the Springfield Journal. The letter was written in the style of Josh Billings and purported to come from a widow residing in the Lost Townships. It was an attempt to laugh down the unjust measure, and in pursuance of this, the writer plied Shields with ridicule. The town was convulsed with laughter, and Shields with fury. The wrath of the little Irishman was funnier than the letter, and the joy of the neighbors increased. Miss Todd and Miss Jane entered into the spirit of the fun. Then they wrote a letter in which Aunt Rebecca proposed to soothe his injured feelings by accepting Shields as her husband. This was followed by a doggerel rhyme celebrating the event. Shields' fury knew no bounds. He went to Francis, the editor of the Journal, and demanded the name of the author of the letters. Francis consulted with Lincoln. The latter was unwilling to permit any odium to fall on the ladies, and sent word to Shields that he would hold himself responsible for those letters. If Shields had not been precisely the kind of man he was, the matter might have been explained and settled amicably. But no, he must have blood. He sent an insulting and peremptory challenge. When Lincoln became convinced that a duel was necessary, he exercised his right as the challenged party of choosing the weapons. He selected broadswords of the largest size. This was another triumph of humor. The midget of the Irishman was to be pitted against the giant of 6 feet 4 inches, who possessed the strength of a Hercules, and the weapons were broadswords of the largest size. The bloody party repaired to Alton, and thence to an island or sandbar on the Missouri side of the river. There a reconciliation was effected, honor was satisfied all around, and they returned home in good spirits. For some reason, Lincoln was always ashamed of this force. Why, we do not know. It may have been because he was drawn into a situation in which there was a possibility of his shedding human blood. And he who was too tender-hearted to shoot wild game could not make light of that situation. The engagement between Lincoln and Miss Todd was renewed, and they were quietly married at the home of the bride's sister, Mrs. Edwards, November 4, 1842. Lincoln made a loyal, true, indulgent husband. Mrs. Lincoln made a home that was hospitable, cultured, and unostentatious. They lived together until the death of the husband more than 22 years later. They had 4 children, all boys. Only the eldest, Robert Todd Lincoln, grew to manhood. He has had a career which is, to say the least, credible to the name he bears. For a few months at the close of the war, he was on the staff of General Grant. He was Secretary of War under Garfield and retained the office through the administration of Arthur. Under President Harrison, from 1889 to 1893, he was Minister to England. He is a lawyer by profession, residing in Chicago, the city that loved his father, and at the present writing is President of the Pullman Company. In every position he has occupied, he has exercised a notably wide influence. Chapter 11, The Encroachments of Slavery. It is necessary at this point to take a glance at the history of American slavery in order to understand Lincoln's career. In 1619, or 1 year before the landing of the Mayflower at Plymouth, a Dutch man of war landed a cargo of slaves at Jamestown, Virginia. For nearly 2 centuries after this, the slave trade was more or less brisk. The slaves were distributed, though unevenly, over all the colonies. But as time passed, differences appeared. In the North, the public conscience was awake to the injustice of the institution, while in the South it was not. There were many exceptions in both localities, but the public sentiment, the general feeling, was as stated. There was another difference. Slave labor was more valuable in the South than in the North. This was due to the climate. The Negro does not take kindly to the rigors of the North, while in the South the heat, which is excessive to the white man, is precisely suited to the Negro. In the course of years, therefore, there came to be comparatively few Negroes in the North, while large numbers were found in the South. It is generally conceded that the founders of our government look forward to the gradual extinction of slavery. In the first draft of the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson inserted some scathing remarks about the king's part in the slave traffic. But it was felt that such remarks would come with ill grace from colonies that abetted slavery, and the passage was stricken out. It was, however, provided that the slave trade should cease in the year 1808. The Ordinance of 1787 recognized the difference in sentiment of the two portions of the country on the subject and was enacted as a compromise. Like several subsequent enactments, it was supposed to set the agitation of the subject forever at rest. This ordinance provided that slavery should be excluded from the Northwestern Territory. At that time, the Mississippi River formed the western boundary of the country, and the territory thus ordained to be free was that out of which the 5 states of Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin were subsequently formed. It was not then dreamed that the future acquisition of new territory or the sudden appreciation of the value of the slave would reopen the question. But 3 facts changed the entire complexion of the subject. It was discovered that the soil and climate of the South were remarkably well adapted to the growth of cotton. Then the development of steam power and machinery in the manufacture of cotton goods created a sudden enormous demand from Liverpool, Manchester, and other cities in England for American cotton. There remained an obstacle to the supply of this demand. This was the difficulty of separating the cotton fiber from the seed. A Negro woman was able to clean about 1 pound of cotton in a day. In 1793, Eli Whitney, a graduate of Yale College, was teaching school in Georgia and boarding with a widow of General Greene. Certain planters were complaining in the hearing of Mrs. Greene of the difficulty of cleaning cotton when she declared that the Yankee schoolteacher could solve the difficulty, that he was so ingenious that there was almost nothing he could not do. The matter was brought to Whitney's attention, who protested that he knew nothing of the subject. He hardly knew a cotton seed when he saw it. Nevertheless, he set to work and invented the cotton gin. By this machine, one man turning a crank could clean 50 pounds of cotton a day. The effect of this was to put a new face upon the cotton trade. It enabled the planters to meet the rapidly increasing demand for raw cotton. It had an equal influence on the slavery question. Only Negroes can work successfully in the cotton fields. There was a phenomenal increase in the demand for Negro labor. And this was 15 years before the time limit of the slave trade in 1808. There soon came to be a decided jealousy between the slaveholding and the non-slaveholding portion of the country, which continually increased. At the time of the Ordinance of 1787, the two parts of the country were evenly balanced. Each section kept a vigilant watch on the other section so as to avoid losing the balance of power. As the country enlarged, this balance was preserved by the admission of free and slave states in turn. Vermont was paired with Kentucky, Tennessee with Ohio, Louisiana with Indiana, and Mississippi with Illinois. In 1836, Michigan and Arkansas were admitted on the same day. This indicates that the jealousy of the two parties was growing more acute. Then Texas was admitted December 29, 1845, and was not balanced until the admission of Wisconsin in 1848. We must now go back to the admission of Missouri. It came into the Union as a slave state by what is known as the Missouri Compromise of 1820. By this compromise, the concession of slavery to Missouri was offset by the enactment that all slavery should be forever excluded from the territory west of that state and north of its southern boundary, namely the parallel of 36 degrees, 30 minutes. The mutterings of the conflict were heard at the time of the admission of Texas in 1848. It was again set forever at rest by what was known as the Wilmot Proviso. A year or two later, the discovery of gold in California and the acquisition of New Mexico reopened the whole question. Henry Clay of Kentucky, a slaveholder but opposed to the extension of slavery, was then a member of the House. By a series of compromises, he had a brilliant talent for compromise, he once more set the whole question forever at rest. This rest lasted for 4 years. But in 1852, Mrs. Harriet Beecher Stowe published Uncle Tom's Cabin, an event of national importance. To a degree unprecedented, it roused the conscience of those who were opposed to slavery and inflamed the wrath of those who favored it. The sudden and rude awakening from this rest came in 1854 with the repeal of the Missouri Compromise. The overland travel to California after the year 1848 had given to the intervening territory an importance far in excess of its actual population. It early became desirable to admit into the Union both Kansas and Nebraska, and the question arose whether slavery should be excluded according to the Act of 1820. The slaveholding residents of Missouri were hostile to the exclusion of slavery. It was situated just beyond their border, and there is no wonder that they were unable to see any good reason why they could not settle there with their slaves. They had the sympathy of the slave states generally. On the other hand, the free states were bitterly opposed to extending the slave power. To them it seemed that the slaveholders were planning for a vast empire of slavery, an empire which should include not only the southern half of the United States, but also Mexico, Central America, and possibly a portion of South America. The advocates of slavery certainly presented and maintained an imperious and despotic temper. Feeling was running high on both sides in the early 50s. A leading cyclopedia concludes a brief article on the Missouri Compromise with a parenthetical reference, C. Douglas, Stephen A. The implication contained in these words is fully warranted. The chief event in the life of Douglas is the repeal of the Missouri Compromise, and the history of the Missouri Compromise cannot be written without giving large place to the activity of Douglas. His previous utterances had not led observers, however watchful, to suspect this. In the Compromise of 1850, he had spoken with great emphasis. In taking leave of this subject, I wish to state that I have determined never to make another speech upon the slavery question. We claim that the compromise is a final settlement. Those who preach peace should not be the first to commence and reopen an old quarrel. This was the man who 4 years later recommenced and reopened this old quarrel of slavery. In the meantime, something had occurred. In 1852, he had been the unsuccessful candidate for the Democratic nomination for president, and he had aspirations for the nomination in 1856, when a nomination would have been equivalent to an election. It thus seemed politic for him to make some decided move which would secure him the loyalty of the slave power. Upon Stephen A. Douglas rested the responsibility of the repeal of the Missouri Compromise. He was at that time chairman of the Senate Committee on Territories. His personal friend and political manager for Illinois, William A. Richardson, held a similar position in the House. The control of the legislation upon this subject was then absolutely in the hands of Senator Douglas, the man who had determined never to make another speech on the slavery question. It is not within the scope of this book to go into the details of this iniquitous plot, for plot it was. But the following passage may be quoted as exhibiting the method of the bill. It being the true intent and meaning of this act not to legislate slavery into any territory or state, nor to exclude it therefrom, but to leave the people thereof perfectly free to form and regulate their domestic institutions in their own way, subject only to the Constitution. In other words, no state or territory could be surely safe from the intrusion of slavery. Lincoln had been practicing law and had been out of politics for 6 years. It was this bill which called him back to politics like a fire bell in the night. Chapter 12. The Awakening of the Lion. The repeal of the Missouri Compromise caused great excitement throughout the land. The conscience of the anti-slavery portion of the community was shocked, as was also that of the large numbers of people who, though not opposed to slavery in itself, were opposed to its extension. It showed that this institution had a deadening effect upon the moral nature of the people who cherished it. There was no compromise so generous that would satisfy their greed. There were no promises so solemn that they could be depended on to keep them. They were not content with maintaining slavery in their own territory. It was not enough that they should be allowed to take slaves into a territory consecrated to freedom, nor that all the powers of the law were devoted to recapturing a runaway slave and returning him to renewed horrors. They wanted all the territories which they had promised to let alone. It was a logical and an altogether probable conclusion that they only waited for the opportunity to invade the northern states and turn them from free soil into slave territory. The indignation over this outrage not only flamed from thousands of pulpits, but newspapers and political clubs of all kinds took up the subject on one side or the other. Every moralist became a politician, and every politician discussed the moral bearings of his tenets. In no locality was this excitement more intense than in Illinois. There were special reasons for this. It is a very long state, stretching nearly 500 miles from north to south. Now it is a general law among Americans that migration follows very nearly the parallels of latitude from east to west. For this reason, the northern portion of the state was mostly settled by northern people whose sympathies were against slavery, while the southern portion of the state was mostly settled by southern people whose sympathies were in favor of slavery. The state was nearly evenly divided, and the presence of these two parties kept up a continual friction and intensified the feeling on both sides. To this general condition must be added the fact that Illinois was the home of Douglas, who was personally and almost solely responsible for the repeal of the Missouri Compromise. In that state he had risen from obscurity to be the most conspicuous man in the United States. His party had a decided majority in the state, and over it he had absolute control. He was their idol. Imperious by nature, shrewd, unscrupulous, a debater of marvelous skill, a master of assemblies, a man who knew not the meaning of the word fail, this was Douglas. But his home was in Chicago, a city in which the anti-slavery sentiment predominated. When Douglas returned to his state, his in more than one sense, it was not as a conquering hero. He did not return directly from Washington, but delayed, visiting various portions of the country. Possibly this was due to the urgency of business. Probably it was in order to give time for the excitement to wear itself out. But this did not result, and his approach was the occasion of a fresh outbreak of feeling in Chicago. The demonstrations of the residents of that city were not a flattering welcome home. Bells were tolled as for public mourning. Flags were hung at half-mast. Nothing was omitted that might emphasize the general aversion to the man who had done that infamous deed. A public meeting was planned, at which he was to speak in defense of his course. A large crowd, about 5,000 people, gathered. Douglas was surrounded by his own friends, but the major portion of the crowd was intensely hostile to him. When he began to speak, the opposition broke out. He was interrupted by questions and comments. These so exasperated him that he completely lost control of himself. He stormed. He shook his fist. He railed. The meeting broke up in confusion. Then came a reaction which greatly profited him. the papers published that he had attempted to speak and had not been allowed to do so, but had been hooted by a turbulent mob, all of which was true. By the time he spoke again, the sympathy of the public had swung to his side, and he was sure of a favorable hearing. This second speech was on the occasion of the state fair at Springfield. Men of all kinds and of every political complexion were present from even the remotest localities in the state. The speech was to be an address to a large audience fairly representative of the entire state. Lincoln was there, not merely because Springfield was his home. He doubtless would have been there anyhow. His ability as a politician, his growing fame as a lawyer and a public speaker, his well-known antipathy to slavery, singled him out as the one man who was preeminently fitted to answer the speech of Douglas, and he was by a tacit agreement selected for this purpose. Lincoln himself felt the stirring impulse. It is not uncommon for the call of duty or opportunity to come once in a lifetime to the heart of a man with overmastering power, so that his purpose and powers are roused to an unwonted and transforming degree of activity. It is the flight of the eaglet, the awakening of the lion, the transfiguration of the human spirit. To Lincoln this call now came. He was the same man, but he had reached another stage of development, entered a new experience, exhibiting new powers, or the old powers to such a degree that they were virtually new. It is the purpose of this chapter to note three of his speeches which attest to this awakening. The first of these was delivered at the State Fair at Springfield. Douglas had spoken October 3, 1854. Lincoln was present, and it was mentioned by Douglas, and was by all understood, that he would reply the following day, October 4th. Douglas was, up to that time, not only the shrewdest politician in the country, but he was acknowledged to be the ablest debater. He was particularly well prepared upon this subject, for to it he had given almost his entire time for nearly a year, and had discussed it in Congress and out, and knew thoroughly the current objections. The occasion was unusual, and this was to be, and doubtless it was, his greatest effort. The following day came Lincoln's reply. As a matter of fairness, he said at the outset that he did not want to present anything but the truth. If he said anything that was not true, he would be glad to have Douglas correct him at once. Douglas, with customary shrewdness, took advantage of this offer by making frequent interruptions so as to break the effect of the logic and destroy the flow of thought. Finally, Lincoln's patience was exhausted, and he paused in his argument to say, "Gentlemen, I cannot afford to spend my time in quibbles. I take the responsibility of asserting the truth myself, relieving Judge Douglas from the necessity of his impertinent corrections." This silenced his opponent, and he spoke without further interruption to the end, his speech being 3 hours and 10 minutes long. The effect of the speech was wonderful. The scene, as described next day in the Springfield Journal, is worth quoting. Lincoln quivered with feeling and emotion. The whole house was as still as death. He attacked the bill with unusual warmth and energy, and all felt that a man of strength was its enemy, and that he meant to blast it if he could by strong and manly efforts. He was most successful, and the house approved the glorious triumph of truth by loud and long-continued huzzas. Mr. Lincoln exhibited Douglas in all the attitudes he could be placed in a friendly debate. He exhibited the bill in all its aspects to show its humbuggery and falsehoods, and when thus torn to rags, cut into slips, held up to the gaze of the vast crowd, a kind of scorn was visible upon the face of the crowd and upon the lips of the most eloquent speaker. At the conclusion of the speech, every man felt that it was unanswerable, that no human power could overthrow it or trample it underfoot. The long and repeated applause evinced the feelings of the crowd, and gave token to of the universal assent to Lincoln's whole argument, and every mind present did homage to the man who took captive the heart and broke like a sun over the understanding. The speech itself and the manner of its reception could not other than rouse Douglas to a tempest of wrath. it was a far more severe punishment than to be hooted from the stage as he had been in Chicago. He was handled as he had never been handled in his life. He took the platform, angrily claimed that he had been abused, and started to reply. But he did not get far. He had no case. He became confused, lost his self-control, hesitated. Finally, he said that he would reply in the evening and left the stage. That was the end of the incident so far as Douglas was concerned. When the evening came, he had disappeared. There was no reply. 12 days later, on October 16th, Lincoln had promised to speak in Peoria. To that place, Douglas followed or preceded him. Douglas made his speech in the afternoon, and Lincoln followed in the evening. It was the same line of argument as in the other speech. Lincoln later consented to write it out for publication. We thus have the Springfield and Peoria speech, minus the glow of extemporaneous address, the inspiration of the order. These are important factors which not even the man himself could reproduce. But we have his own report, which is therefore authentic. The most salient point in his speech is his reply to Douglas's plausible representation that the people of any locality were competent to govern themselves. "I admit," said Lincoln, "that the emigrant to Kansas and Nebraska is competent to govern himself. But I deny his right to govern any other person without that other person's consent. This is the kernel of the entire question of human slavery." The result of this speech at Peoria was less dramatic than that at Springfield, but it was no less instructive. Douglas secured from Lincoln an agreement that neither of them should again speak during that campaign. It was quite evident that he had learned to fear his antagonist and did not wish again to risk meeting him on the rostrum. Lincoln kept the agreement. Douglas did not. Before he got home in Chicago, he stopped off to make another speech. These speeches were made in 1854. It is now worthwhile to skip over 2 years to record another epoch-making speech, one which in spirit and temper belongs here, for it shows to what intensity Lincoln was aroused on this vast and ever-encroaching subject of slavery. This was at the convention which was held in Bloomington for the purpose of organizing the Republican Party. The date of the convention was May 29th, 1865. The center of interest was Lincoln's speech. The reporters were there in sufficient force, and we would surely have had a verbatim report, except for one thing. The reporters did not report. Let Joseph Medill of the Chicago Tribune tell why. "It was my journalistic duty, though a delegate to the convention, to make a longhand report of the speeches delivered for the Chicago Tribune. I did make a few paragraphs of what Lincoln said in the first 8 or 10 minutes, but I became so absorbed in his magnetic oratory that I forgot myself and ceased to take notes, and joined with the convention in cheering and stamping and clapping to the end of the speech. I well remember that after Lincoln had sat down and calm had succeeded the tempest, I waked out of a sort of hypnotic trance, and then thought of my report for the Tribune. There was nothing written but an abbreviated introduction. It was some sort of satisfaction to find that I had not been scooped, as all the newspaper men present had been equally carried away by the excitement caused by the wonderful oration and had made no report or sketch of the speech. Mr. Herndon, who was Lincoln's law partner and knew him so intimately that he might be trusted to keep his coolness during the enthusiasm of the hour, and who had the mechanical habit of taking notes for him because he was his partner, said, "I attempted for about 15 minutes, as was usual with me then, to take notes. But at the end of that time, I threw pen and paper away and lived only in the inspiration of the hour." There is no doubt that the audience was generally, if not unanimously, affected in the same way. The hearers went home and told about this wonderful speech. Journalists wrote flaming editorials about it. The fame of it went everywhere, but there was no report of it. It therefore came to be known as Lincoln's Law Speech. Precisely 40 years afterward, one H.C. Whitney published in one of the magazines an account of it. He says that he made notes of the speech, went home, and wrote them out. why he withheld this report from the public for so many years, especially in view of the general demand for it, does not precisely appear. The report, however, is interesting. But after the lapse of nearly half a century, it is a matter of minor importance whether Mr. Whitney's report be accurate or not. To us, the value of the three speeches mentioned in this chapter is found largely in the impression they produced upon the hearers. The three taken together show that Lincoln had waked to a new life. The lion in him was thoroughly roused. He was clothed with a tremendous power which up to this point had not been suspected by antagonists nor dreamed of by admiring friends. This new and mighty power he held and wielded until his life's end. Thenceforth he was an important factor in national history.
Thanks everyone for listening. Before I continue on with part four of the life of Abraham Lincoln, taken from the book of the same name written by Henry Ketchum, just wanted to remind you to listen in Sunday night to the 103rd edition of the Patriot Hour, where General Rachel and I try to make sense of all this nonsense. Now I'm going to break it up a little bit and play a song for you.
Thank you.
Now, for part four of the life of Abraham Lincoln, taken from the book of the same name written by Henry Kitchener.
Chapter 13, Two Things That Lincoln Missed. Lincoln's intimate friends have noted that he seemed to be under the impression that he was a man of destiny. This phrase was a favorite with Napoleon, who often used it of himself. But the two men were so widely different in character and career that it is with reluctance that one joins their name, even for the moment that this phrase is used. Napoleon was eager to sacrifice the whole of Europe to satisfy the claims of his personal ambition. Lincoln was always ready to stand aside and sacrifice himself for the country. The one was selfishness incarnate. The other was a noble example of a man who never hesitated to subordinate his own welfare to the general good, and whose career came to its climax in his martyrdom. Whether the presidency was or was not Lincoln's destiny, it was certainly his destination. Had anything occurred to thrust him one side in this career, it would have prevented his complete development and would have been an irreparable calamity to his country and to the world. Twice in his life he earnestly desired certain offices and failed to get them. Had he succeeded in either case, it is not at all probable that he would ever have become president. One therefore rejoices in the knowledge that he missed them. After his term in Congress, he was, in a measure, out of employment. Political life is like to destroy one's taste for the legitimate practice of the law, as well as to scatter one's clients. Lincoln was not a candidate for re-election. Upon the election of General Taylor, it was generally understood that the Democrats would be turned out of office and their places supplied by Whigs. The office of Land Commissioner was expected to go to Illinois. At the solicitation of friends, he applied for it. But so fearful was he that he might stand in the way of others or impede the welfare of the state that he did not urge his application until too late. The president offered him the governorship of the territory of Oregon, which he declined. Had he been successful in his application, it would have kept him permanently out of the study and practice of the law. It would have kept his residence in Washington so that it would not have been possible for him to hold himself in touch with his neighbors. So far as concerned his illustrious career, it would have sidetracked him. He himself recognized this later, and was glad that he had failed in this, his first and only application for a government appointment. About 6 years later, he again missed an office to which he aspired. This was in 1854, the year of the speeches at Springfield and Peoria described in the last chapter. Shields, the man of the duel with broadswords, was United States Senator. His term of office was about to expire, and the legislature would elect his successor. The state of Illinois had been Democratic. Both the Senators Shields and Douglas were Democrats. But owing to the new phases of the slavery question, the anti-slavery men were able to carry the legislature, though by a narrow margin. Lincoln had been very useful to the party during the campaign and had been elected to the legislature from his own district. He wanted to be senator. He was unquestionably the choice of nearly all the Whigs. Had an election taken place then, he would undoubtedly have been elected. But a curious obstacle intervened. There was a provision in the Constitution of Illinois which disqualified members of the legislature from holding the office of United States Senator. Lincoln was therefore not eligible. He could only become so by resigning his seat. There appeared to be no risk in this, for he had a safe majority of 605. It seemed as though he could name his successor. But there are many uncertainties in politics. The campaign had been one of unusual excitement, and it was followed by that apathy which is the common sequel to all excessive activity. The Democrats kept quiet. They put up no candidate. They fostered the impression that they would take no part in the special election. Only one Democrat was casually named as a possible victim to be sacrificed to the triumph of the Whigs. He was not a popular nor an able man and would not be feared as a candidate for this office. But the unusual quietness of the Democrats was the most dangerous sign. They had organized a still hunt. This was an adroit move, but it was perfectly fair. It is not difficult to guess whose shrewdness planned this, seeing that the question was vital to the career of Douglas. The Democratic Party preserved their organization. The trusted lieutenants held the rank and file in readiness for action. When the polls were opened on Election Day, the Democrats were there and the Whigs were not. At every election precinct appeared Democratic workers to electioneer for the man of their choice. Carriages were provided for the aged, the infirm, and the indifferent who were driven to the polls so that their votes were saved to the party. The Whigs were completely taken by surprise. It was too late to talk up their candidate. They had no provision and no time to get the absent and indifferent to the polls. The result was disastrous to them. Lincoln's safe majority was wiped out, and a Douglas Democrat was chosen to succeed him. It may be surmised that this did not tend to fill the Whigs with enthusiasm, nor to unite the party. From all over the state there arose grumblings that the Sangamon contingent of the party had been so ignobly outwitted. Lincoln had to bear the brunt of this discontent. This was not unnatural nor unreasonable, for he was the party manager for that district. When the legislature went into joint session, Lincoln had manifestly lost some of his prestige. It may be said by way of palliation that the still hunt was then new in politics, and it was the only time that Lincoln was caught napping. Even with the loss to the Whigs of this seat, the Douglas Democrats were in a minority. Lincoln had a plurality, but not a majority. The balance of power was held by 5 anti-Nebraska Democrats, who would not under any circumstances vote for Lincoln or another Whig. Their candidate was Lyman Trumbull. After a long and weary deadlock, the Democrats dropped their candidate Shields and took up the governor of the state. The governor has presumably a strong influence with the legislature, and this move of the partisans was a real menace to the anti-slavery men. Lincoln recognized the danger, at once withdrew his candidacy, and persuaded all the anti-slavery men to unite on Trumbull. This was no ordinary conciliation, for upon every subject except the Nebraska question alone, Trumbull was an uncompromising Democrat. The Whig votes gave him the necessary majority. The man who started in with 5 votes won the prize. Lincoln not only failed to get into the Senate, but he was out of the legislature. In commenting on this defeat of Lincoln for the United States Senate, the present writer wishes, first of all, to disavow all superstitions and all belief in signs. But there is one fact which is worthy of mention, and for which different persons will propose different explanations. It is a fact that in all the history of the United States, no person has been elected direct from the Senate to the presidency. This is the more interesting because the prominent senator wields a very powerful influence, an influence second only to that of the president himself. When one considers the power of a leading senator, one would suppose that that was the natural stepping stone to the presidency. But history does not support this supposition. It teaches the opposite. Many prominent senators have greatly desired to be president, but no one has succeeded unless he first retired from the Senate. Among the more widely known aspirants to the presidency who have been unsuccessful are Jackson, his first candidacy, Clay, Webster, Douglas, Morton, Seward, Sherman, and Blaine. So many failures may be a mere coincidence. On the other hand, there may be a reason for them. They seem to teach that the Senate is not the best start for the presidential race, but the worst. The history of ethics teaches that the most determined hostility against the best is the good, not the bad. So it may be that in the politics of this country, the greatest obstacle to the highest position may be the next highest. These facts, of course, do not prove that if Lincoln had been elected senator in 1854 or in 1858 when he was the opposing candidate to Douglas, he would therefore have failed of election to the presidency. He may have been the exception. He may have been the only one to break this rule in over 100 years. But the sequel proved that he was best where he was. He remained among his people. He moused about the state library, enduring criticism, but mastering the history of slavery. he kept a watchful eye on the progress of events. He was always alert to seize an opportunity and proclaim in trumpet tones the voice of conscience, the demands of eternal righteousness. But he waited. His hour had not yet come. He bided his time. It was not a listless waiting. It was intensely earnest and active. Far more than he could realize, he was in training for the stupendous responsibilities which should in due time fall upon him. It is fortunate for all that he did not learn to limit his powers to the arena of the Senate, which, though great, is limited. He kept near to the people. When his hour struck, he was ready. For this reason, we call his two failures escapes. He did not get the government land office. He did not get the senatorship. He did get the presidency, and that in the crisis of the history of the nation. What is more, when he got that, he was thoroughly furnished unto every good work. Chapter 14, The Birth of the Republican Party. In the course of history, there sometimes arises a man who has a marvelous power of attaching others to himself. He commands a measure of devotion and enthusiasm which is impossible fully to understand. Such a man was Henry Clay. Under the fascination of his qualities, Lincoln lived. From childhood to maturity, Clay had been his idol, and Clay's party, the Whig, nearly synonymous with all that was desirable in American politics. It was therefore no easy matter for Lincoln to leave the Whig party. Nothing could accomplish this but the overmastering power of a noble emotion. From childhood, Lincoln had hated slavery. The fact that Kentucky was a slave state had its influence in his father's removal to Indiana. His personal observations upon his journeys down the Mississippi River had given him a keener feeling on the subject. The persistent and ever-increasing outrages of the slave power had intensified his hatred. The time had come when he, and such as he, felt that other party questions were of minor importance and that everything else should for the time be subordinated to the supreme question of slavery. There were certain reasons why the Whig party could not accomplish the desired end. Its history had identified it with a different class of subjects. Though Clay himself and a majority of his party were opposed to the extension of slavery, there were still pro-slavery men in its ranks in sufficient numbers to prevent any real efficiency on the slavery question. On the other hand, while the Democratic Party was overwhelmingly pro-slavery, there were anti-slavery Democrats who, from their numbers, ability, and character, were not to be overlooked. The election to the Senate of Lyman Trumbull as an anti-Douglas Democrat had crystallized this wing of the party. The fiasco of Lincoln's defeat when the Whigs were in good plurality caused much discontent in that party. If the anti-slavery men were to be united for efficiency in opposing Douglas, it must be under another organization. A new party must be formed. In this, the newspapers took the initiative. A number of papers editorially called for a convention, which was really a mass meeting, for there were no accredited delegates and could be none. This met in Decatur on Washington's birthday, 1856. It was a motley assembly from a political standpoint. It included Whigs, Democrats, Free Soilers, Abolitionists, and Know-Nothings. Said Lincoln, "Of strange, discordant, even hostile elements, we gathered from the four winds." Politicians were conspicuously absent, for it would imperil their political orthodoxy to be seen there. Lincoln was the principal one who had anything to lose. He was consulted on all measures and gave freely of his counsel. The proceedings ended with a dinner at which he made a speech. He was the most prominent man in the new movement, was popular throughout the state, and was the logical candidate for governor. He would have been highly gratified with the candidacy. But again he put personal desires aside that the general good might not be endangered. He therefore proposed in his after-dinner speech for nomination of a Democrat who had a record of earnest opposition to the slave power. Refusing the use of his own name, he added, "But I can suggest a name that will secure not only the old Whig vote, but enough anti-Nebraska Democrats to give us the victory. That man is Colonel William H. Bissell." Bissell was afterwards regularly nominated and triumphantly elected. The meeting at Decatur called for a convention to be held at Bloomington on the 29th of May. About the same thing had been going on in some other free states. On the very day of the Decatur meeting, there was a notable meeting for the same purpose in Pittsburgh. This was attended by E.D. Morgan, Governor of New York, Horace Greeley, O.P. Morton, Zechariah Chandler, Joshua R. Giddings, and other prominent men. They issued the call for the first national convention of the Republican Party to be held in Philadelphia in June. In May, the Illinois Convention assembled in Bloomington, and the most conspicuous person there was Lincoln. It was there that he made the amazing speech already described. It was the speech which held even the reporters in such a spell that they could not report it. It is known in history as the Lost Speech, but the fame of it endures to this day. The Democratic Convention met in Cincinnati early in June and nominated James Buchanan to succeed Franklin Pierce. Thus Douglas was for a second time defeated for the nomination. The Republican Convention met a few days later in Philadelphia. At that time, John C. Fremont was at the height of his fame. His character was romantic, and the record of his adventures was as fascinating as a novel by Dumas. He had earned the name of Pathfinder by crossing the continent. Although unauthorized, he had in California raised a military company which was of material assistance to the naval forces of the United States against a Mexican insurrection. He was an ardent hater of slavery. He was precisely the man, a standard-bearer, to infuse enthusiasm into the new party and to give it a good start in its career. He did this, and did it well. The large vote which he polled augured well for the future. All this we may claim without denying the fact that it was fortunate for the party and for the country that he was not elected. There was no doubt of his sincerity and his patriotism, but he lacked self-control, wariness, and patience. He was hot-headed, extreme, egotistical. He never could have carried the burdens of the first administration of the Republican Party. When the election was over, it was found that Buchanan had carried every slave state except Maryland, which went to Fillmore. Fremont had carried every New England state and five other northern states. Buchanan received 174 electoral votes, Fremont 114, Fillmore 8. The popular vote was, for Buchanan, 1,838,169. For Fremont, 1,341,264. For Fillmore, 874,534. That was an excellent showing for the new party. It showed that it had come to stay and gave a reasonable hope of a victory at the next presidential election. Lincoln was at the head of the electoral ticket of the state of Illinois. He usually was on the ticket. He playfully called himself one of the electors that seldom elect anybody. In Illinois, the honor of the election were evenly divided between the two parties. Buchanan carried the state by a handsome majority, but Bissell was elected governor by a good majority. Lincoln had faithfully canvassed the state and made nearly 50 speeches. One paragraph from a speech made in Galena should be quoted. The slave party had raised the cry of sectionalism and had charged that the Republicans proposed to destroy the Union. Lincoln said, "But the Union in any event will not be dissolved. We don't want to dissolve it, and if you attempt it, we won't let you. With the purse and sword and the army, the navy and the treasury in our hands and at our command, you could not do it. This government would be very weak indeed if a majority with a disciplined army and navy and a well-filled treasury could not preserve itself when attacked by an unarmed, undisciplined minority. All this talk about the dissolution of the Union is humbug, nothing but folly. We do not want to dissolve the Union. You shall not." These words were prophetic of the condition of the country and of his own policy 4 or 5 years later. But he apparently did not apprehend that an unscrupulous administration might steal the army and the munitions of war, scatter the navy, and empty the treasury. On the 10th of December, Lincoln spoke at a Republican banquet in Chicago. It was after the election, after Buchanan's supercilious message to Congress. The purpose of the speech was to forecast the future of the young party. The following quotations may be read with interest. He, Buchanan, in his speech to Congress, says that the people did it. He forgets that the people, as he complacently calls only those who voted for Buchanan, are in a minority of the whole people by about 400,000 votes. All of us who did not vote for Mr. Buchanan taken together are a majority of 400,000. But in the late contest we were divided between Fremont and Fillmore. Can we not come together for the future? Let everyone who really believes and is resolved that free society is not and shall not be a failure, and who can conscientiously declare that in the past contest he has done only what he thought best, let every such one have charity to believe that every other one can say as much. Let bygones be bygones. Let past differences as nothing be. And with steady eye on the real issue, let us reinaugurate the good old central ideas of the Republic. We can do it. The human heart is with us. God is with us. We shall again be able to declare not that all states as states are equal, nor yet that all citizens as citizens are equal, but to renew the broader, better declaration, including these and much more, that all men are created equal. It was upon the wisdom of this plan that 4 years later he held the foes of slavery united while the foes of freedom were divided among themselves. It was this that carried the party to its first victory and made him president. Chapter 15, The Battle of the Giants. The admiring friends of Douglas had given him the nickname of the Little Giant. To this he was fairly entitled. Physically he was very little. Intellectually he was a giant. He was in 1858 perhaps the most prominent man in the United States. He was the unquestioned leader of the dominant party. He had been so long in public life that he was familiar with every public question, while upon the burning question of slavery he was the leader. Lincoln was a giant physically, and it soon became evident that he was no less intellectually. These two men soon were to come together in a series of joint debates. It was manifest that this would be a battle of intellectual giants. No other such debates have ever occurred in the history of the country. Events led up to this rapidly and with the certainty of fate. In 1854, Lincoln had been candidate for the Senate to succeed Shields, but his party had been outwitted and he was compelled to substitute Trumbull. In 1856, he was the logical candidate for governor, but he was of the opinion that the cause would be better served permanently by placing an anti-slavery Democrat in the nomination. This was done and Bissell was elected. Now in 1858, the senatorial term of Douglas was about to expire and a successor would be chosen. Douglas was the candidate of his own party. The Republicans turned naturally and spontaneously to Lincoln, for it would be no light task to defeat so strong an opponent. The Republican convention met in Springfield on the 16th of June. Lincoln was by acclamation nominated as the first and only choice of the Republican Party for United States Senator. The above time-honored phrase was used sincerely on that occasion. There was great enthusiasm, absolute unanimity. On the evening of the following day, he addressed the convention in a speech which has become historic. His opening words were, "If we could first know where we are and whither we are tending, we could better judge what to do and how to do it. We are now far into the fifth year since a policy was initiated with the avowed object and confident promise of putting an end to the slavery agitation. Under the operation of that policy, that agitation has not only not ceased, but has constantly augmented. In my opinion, it will not cease until a crisis shall have been reached and passed. A house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. I do not expect the Union to be dissolved. I do not expect the house to fall. But I do expect it will cease to be divided. It will become all one thing or all the other. Either the opponents of slavery will arrest the further spread of it and place it where the public mind shall rest in the belief that it is in the course of ultimate extinction, or its advocates will push it forward till it shall become alike lawful in all the states, old as well as new, north as well as south." This speech came quickly to be known as the House Divided Against Itself speech. By that name it is still known. Concluding, he said, "Our cause then must be entrusted to and conducted by its own undoubted friends, those whose hands are free, whose hearts are in the work, who do not care for the result. The result is not doubtful. We shall not fail. If we stand firm, we shall not fail. Wise counsels may accelerate or mistakes may delay it, but sooner or later the victory is sure to come." This was a strong speech delivered before an audience of men of unusual ability, delegates who represented all parts of the state. It was in no wise a harangue. It was entirely thoughtful and strictly logical. The effect of it was to intensify the enthusiasm and to spread it all through the state. It was a speech that Douglas could not ignore, though he might misrepresent it. This he did by raising the charge of sectionalism against his adversary. About 3 weeks later, on the 9th of July, Douglas made an elaborate speech in Chicago. Lincoln was in the audience. It was unofficially arranged that he should reply. He did so the following evening. A week later, a similar thing occurred in Springfield. Douglas made a speech in the afternoon, to which Lincoln replied in the evening. Shortly after this, Lincoln wrote Douglas a letter proposing a series of joint discussions or challenging him to a series of joint debates. Douglas replied in a patronizing and irritating tone, asked for a slight advantage in his own favor, but he accepted the proposal. He did not do so in a very gracious manner, but he did it. They arranged for 7 discussions in towns, the locations being scattered fairly over the entire territory of the state. If Illinois had before been the cynosure of neighboring eyes, much more was it so now. Lincoln was by no means the most prominent anti-slavery man, but he was the only man in a position to bear his rival. The proposed debates excited not only the interest of the state and the neighboring states, but from the east and south all minds were turned to this tournament. It was not a local discussion. It was a national and critical question that was at issue. The interest was no less eager in New York, Washington, and Charleston than in Indianapolis, Milwaukee, and St. Louis. The two men had been neighbors for many years. They were together members of the legislature, first in Vandalia and then in Springfield. They had frequently met socially in Springfield. Both paid marked attention to the same young lady. Both had served in Washington City. Douglas was for most of his life an office holder, so that in one way or another Lincoln would be brought into association with him. But though they met so frequently, it is not probable that before this time either recognized in the other his supreme antagonist. After the repeal of the Missouri Compromise, Lincoln had, as already related, discussed Douglas with great plainness of speech. This had been twice repeated in this year. But these were, comparatively speaking, mere incidents. The great contest was to be in the debates. In the outset, Douglas had the advantage of prestige. Nothing succeeds like success. Douglas had all his life had nothing but success. He twice had missed the nomination for presidency, but he was still the most formidable man in the Senate. He was very popular in his own state. He was everywhere greeted by large crowds, with bands of music and other demonstrations. He always traveled in a special car and often in a special train, which was freely placed at his disposal by the Illinois Central Railway. Lincoln traveled by accommodation train, freight train, or wagon as best as he could. As both the men were every day speaking independently between the debates, this question of transportation was serious. The inconveniences of travel made a great drain upon the nervous force and the health. One day, when the freight train bearing Lincoln was sidetracked to let his rival's special train roll by, he good-humoredly remarked that Douglas did not smell any royalty in this car. Another fact which gave Douglas the advantage was the friendship and sympathy of Horace Greeley and others who had much influence with the party of Lincoln. Douglas had broken with Buchanan's administration on a question relating to Kansas. The iniquity of the powers at Washington went so far that even Douglas rebelled. This led Greeley and others to think that Douglas had in him the making of a good Republican if he was only treated with sufficient consideration. Accordingly, all of that influence was bitterly thrown in opposition to Lincoln. The methods of the two men were as diverse as their bodily appearance. Douglas was a master of what the ancient Greeks would have called making the worse appear the better reason. He was able to misstate his antagonist's position so shrewdly as to deceive the very elect. And with equal skill he could escape from the real meaning of his own statements. Lincoln's characterization is apt. Judge Douglas is playing cuttlefish, a small species of fish that has no mode of defending himself when pursued, except by throwing out a black fluid which makes the water so dark the enemy cannot see it, and thus it escapes. Lincoln's method was to hold the discussion down to the point at issue with clear and forcible statement. He arraigned the iniquity of slavery as an offense against God. He made the phrase "all men" of the Declaration of Independence include the black as well as the white. Said he, There is no reason in the world why the Negro is not entitled to all the natural rights enumerated in the Declaration of Independence, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In the right to eat the bread without the leave of anybody else which his own hand earns, he is my equal, and the equal of Judge Douglas, and the equal of every living man. He quoted Jefferson's remark, "I tremble for my country when I remember that God is just." Mercilessly, he analyzed Douglas's speeches and exposed his sophistry. The forensic ability of the two men is suggestively indicated by the remark of a lady who heard them speak and afterwards said, "I can recall only one fact of the debates, that I felt so sorry for Lincoln while Douglas was speaking, and then so sorry for Douglas while Lincoln was speaking." These debates occupied 7 different evenings of 3 hours each. The speeches were afterwards published in book form and had a wide circulation. These speeches, numbering 21 in all, filled a large volume. It is not the purpose of this chapter to give an outline of the debates. It is only to give a general idea of their result. But out of them came one prominent fact, which so influenced the careers of the two men that it must be briefly recorded. This went by the name of the Freeport Doctrine. In the first debate, Douglas had asked Lincoln a series of questions. The villainy of these questions was in the innuendo. They began, "I desire to know whether Lincoln stands today as he did in 1854 in favor of," etc. Douglas then quoted from the platform of a convention which Lincoln had not attended and with which he had nothing to do. Lincoln denied these insinuations and said that he had never favored these doctrines, but the trick succeeded and the impression was made that Douglas had cornered him. The questions, to all intents and purposes, were a forgery. This forgery was quickly exposed by a Chicago paper, and the result was not helpful to Douglas. It was made manifest that he was not conducting the debates in a fair and manly way. Further than this, the fact that these questions had been asked gave Lincoln, in turn, the right to ask questions of Douglas. This right he used. For the next debate, which was to be at Freeport, he prepared, among others, the following question. "Can the people of a United States territory, in any lawful way, against the wishes of any citizen of the United States, exclude slavery from its limits prior to the formation of a state constitution?" If this were answered no, it would alienate the citizens of Illinois. If it were answered yes, it would alienate the Democrats of the South. On the way to Freeport, he met a number of friends and took counsel of them. When he read question number 2, the one above quoted, his friends earnestly and unanimously advised him not to put that question. "If you do," said they, "you can never be senator." To which Lincoln replied, "Gentlemen, I am killing larger game. If Douglas answers, he can never be president, and the Battle of 1860 is worth 100 of this." It is not probable that Lincoln expected to be in 1860 the nominee of the Republican Party. But he did see the danger of the election of Douglas to the presidency. He was willing to surrender the senatorial election to save the country from a Douglas administration. The sacrifice was made. The prediction proved true. Lincoln lost the senatorship. Douglas lost the presidency. The popular verdict, as shown in the election, was in favor of Lincoln. The Republicans polled 125,430 votes. The Douglas Democrats, 121,609, and the Buchanan Democrats, 5,071. But the apportionment of the legislative districts was such that Douglas had a majority on the joint ballot of the legislature. He received 54 votes to 46 for Lincoln. This secured his re-election to the Senate. The popular verdict outside the state of Illinois was in favor of Lincoln. The Republican Party circulated the volume containing the full report of the speeches. It does not appear that the Democrats did so. This forces the conclusion that the intellectual and moral victory was on the side of Lincoln. There is a pathetic sequel to this. The campaign had been very arduous on Lincoln. Douglas had made 130 speeches in 100 days, not counting Sundays. Lincoln had made probably about the same number. These were not brief addresses from a railway car, but fully elaborated speeches. The labors commenced early in July and continued through the heat of the summer. with Lincoln the inadequate means of travel added to the draft upon his strength. At the end of all this came the triumphant election of his rival. Add to this the fact that the next day he received a letter from the Republican committee saying that their funds would not meet the bills and asking for an additional contribution. The rest is best told in Lincoln's words. Yours of the 15th is just received. I wrote you the same day. As to the pecuniary matter, I am willing to pay according to my ability, but I am the poorest hand living to get others to pay. I have been on expense so long without earning anything that I am absolutely without money now, even for household purposes. Still, if you can put up $250 for me towards discharging the debt of the committee, I will allow it when you and I settle the private matter between us. This, with what I have already paid, and with an outstanding note of mine, will exceed my subscription of $500. This, too, is exclusive of my ordinary expenses during the campaign, all which, being added to my loss of time and business, bears pretty heavily on one no better off in the world's goods than I. But as I had the post of honor, it is not for me to be over nice. You are feeling badly, and this too shall pass away. Never fear. Chapter 16. Growing Audacity of the Slave Power. So closely is the life of Lincoln intertwined with the growth of the slave power that it will be necessary at this point to give a brief space to the latter. It was the persistent, the ever-increasing, the imperious demands of this power that called Lincoln to his post of duty. The feeling upon the subject had reached a high degree of tension at the period we are now considering. To understand this fully, we must go back and come once again down through the period already treated. There are three salient points of development. The first of these is the fugitive slave law. At the adoption of the Constitution, it was arranged that there should be no specific approval of slavery. For this reason, the word slave does not appear in the document. But the idea is there, and the phrase person held to service or labor fully covers the subject. Slaves were a valuable property. The public opinion approved of the institution. To set up one part of the territory as a refuge for escaped slaves would be an infringement of this right of property, and would cause unceasing friction between the various parts of the country. In 1793, which happens to be the year of the invention of the cotton gin, the Fugitive Slave Law was passed. This was for the purpose of enacting measures by which escaped slaves might be recaptured. This law continued in force to 1850. As the years passed, the operations of this law produced results not dreamed of at the outset. There came to be free states, communities in which the very toleration of slavery was an abomination. The conscience of these communities abhorred the institution. Though these people were content to leave slavery unmolested in the slave states, they were angered at having the horrors of slave hunting thrust upon them. In other words, they were unable to reside in any locality, no matter how stringent the laws were in behalf of freedom, where they were not liable to be invaded, their very homes entered by the institution of slavery in its most cruel forms. This aroused a bitter antagonism in the North. Societies were formed to assist fugitive slaves to escape to Canada. Men living at convenient distances along the route were in communication with one another. The fugitives were passed secretly and with great skill along this line. Those societies were known as the Underground Railway. The appropriateness of this name is obvious. The men themselves who secreted the fugitive slaves were said to keep stations on that railway. This organized endeavor to assist the fugitives was met by an increased imperiousness on the part of the slave power. Slavery is imperious in its nature. It almost inevitably cultivates that disposition in those who wield power, so that the case was rendered most exasperating by the passage in 1850 of another fugitive slave law. Nothing could have been devised more surely adapted to inflame the moral sense of those communities that were, in feeling or conscience, opposed to slavery than this law of 1850. This was a reenactment of the law of 1793, but with more stringent and cruel regulations. The concealment or assisting of a fugitive was highly penal. Any home might be invaded and searched. No hearth was safe from intrusion. The Negro could not testify in his own behalf. It was practically impossible to counteract the oath or affidavit of the pretended master, and a premium was practically put upon perjury. The pursuit of slaves became a regular business, and its operation was often indescribably horrible. These cruelties were emphasized chiefly in the presence of those who were known to be adverse to slavery in any form, and they could not escape from the revolting scenes. The culmination of this is what is known as the Dred Scott decision. Dred Scott was a slave in Missouri. He was by his master taken to Fort Snelling, now in the state of Minnesota, then in the territory of Wisconsin. This was free soil, and the slave was, at least while there, free. With the consent of his former master, he married a free woman who had formerly been a slave. Two children were born to them. The master returned to Missouri bringing the Negroes. He there claimed that they, being on slave soil, were restored to the condition of slavery. Scott sued for his freedom and won his case. It was, however, appealed to the Supreme Court of the United States. The first opinion of the court was written by Judge Nelson. This treated of this specific case only. Had this opinion issued as the finding of the court, it would not have aroused general attention. But the court was then dominated by the slave sentiment, and the opportunity of laying down general principles on the subject of slavery could not be resisted. The decision was written by Chief Justice Taney, and it reaches its climax in the declaration that the Negro had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. Professor T.W. Dwight says that much injustice was done to Chief Justice Taney by the erroneous statement that he had himself affirmed that the Negro had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. But while this may be satisfactory to the legal mind, to the lay mind, to the average citizen, it is a distinction without a difference, or at best with a very slight difference. The judge was giving what in his opinion was the law of the land. It was his opinion, nay, it was his decision. Nor was it the unanimous ruling of the court. Two justices dissented. The words quoted are picturesque and are well suited to a battle cry. On every side, with ominous emphasis in the north, one heard that the Negro had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. This was, until 1860, the last and greatest exhibition of audacity on the part of the slave power. There was another exhibition of the spirit of slavery which deserves special mention. This is the history of the settlement of Kansas. That remarkable episode, lasting from 1854 to 1861, requires a volume, not a paragraph, for its narration. It is almost impossible for the imagination of those who live in an orderly, law-abiding community to conceive that such a condition of affairs ever existed in any portion of the United States. The story of Bleeding Kansas will long remain an example of the proverb that truth is stranger than fiction. The repeal of the Missouri Compromise in 1854 opened up to this free territory the possibility of coming into the Union as a slave state. It was to be left to the actual settlers to decide this question. This principle was condensed into the phrase, squatter sovereignty. The only resource left to those who wished Kansas to come in as a free state was to settle it with an anti-slavery population. With this purpose in view, societies were formed in anti-slavery communities extending as far east as the Atlantic coast to assist emigrants. From Iowa, Illinois, Ohio, Massachusetts, and elsewhere, immigrants poured into Kansas. But the slave party had the advantage of geographical location. The slave state of Missouri was only just across the river. It was able at short notice and with little expense to pour out its population in large numbers. This it did. Many went from Missouri as actual settlers. By far the larger number went only temporarily and for the purpose of creating a great disturbance. These were popularly called border ruffians. Their excesses of ruffianism are not easily described. they went into the territory for the purpose of driving out all the settlers who had come in under the emigrant aid societies. Murder was common. At the elections, they practiced intimidation and every form of election fraud then known. Every election was contested, and both parties always claimed the victory. The parties elected two separate legislatures, adopted two constitutions, established two capitals. For several years, civil war and anarchy prevailed. There is no doubt, either reasonable or unreasonable, there is no doubt whatever that the anti-slavery men had a vast majority of actual settlers. The territorial governors were appointed by Presidents Pierce and Buchanan. These were uniformly pro-slavery and extremely partisan. But every governor quickly came to side with the Free State men or else resigned to get out of the way. The pro-slavery men, after the farce of a pretended vote, declared the Lecompton Constitution adopted. The governor at that time was Walker of Mississippi, who had been appointed as a sure friend of the interest of slavery. But even he revolted at so gross an outrage, and made a personal visit to Washington to protest against it. It was at this point, too, that Senator Douglas broke with the administration. In spite of the overwhelming majority of anti-slavery settlers in the state, Kansas was not admitted to the Union until after the inauguration of Abraham Lincoln. So unscrupulous, imperious, grasping was the slave power. Whom the gods wish to destroy, they first make mad. The slave power had reached the reckless point of madness and was rushing to its own destruction. These three manifestations, the Fugitive Slave Law, the Dred Scott decision, and the anarchy in Kansas, though they were revolting in the extreme and indescribably painful, hastened the end.
Thank you, everyone, for being here with me tonight. Before I close out the show, I'm going to play a couple of songs. But before I do, I just want to remind you to listen in on Sunday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time for the 103rd edition of the Patriot Hour. Along with General Rachel and myself, we will try to make sense out of all this nonsense. Also, I want to remind you to have your pet muzzy spayed or neutered. And now the first song is Stardust by Glenn Miller.
Thank you.
to thank everyone for being with me tonight. And now, Moonlight Serenade by Glenn Miller. Now, Benny Goodman, sing, sing, sing. Good night, everyone. Have a great weekend.